Did you hear him talking about it on the radio? Did you try to read the writing on the wall? Did that voice inside you say, I've heard it all before? It's like deja vu.
And a long, hard road it's been. Welcome to The Long Haul, a new monthly radio program KMXT is rolling out in collaboration with the Kodiak History Museum. We're 2 years and counting in this pandemic, 2 years of waiting and watching as our community has struggled to navigate its way through pain, uncertainty, and disruption that COVID-19 has brought into our lives. It's been a long haul for all of us, and that's what's going to be our focus over the next few months as we sit down with some of our neighbors to talk about where we were, where we are, and where we're going in regard to making it through the pandemic. If you'd like to ask questions of our guests, please call the station at 486-3181 or send your questions to longhaul@kmxt.org during the show. You can find a list of upcoming guests on our Facebook page or on our website, kmxt.org. If you'd like to participate in a future program, either call the station or send us an email. The Long Haul, stories from the pandemic in Kodiak. Here's today's host.
Walker. I'm the curator at the Kodiak History Museum, and welcome to KMXT and Kodiak History Museum's new partnership show, The Long Haul. This show is being produced in conjunction with our new temporary exhibit, Making History Day by Day, Kodiak, Our Stories in the COVID-19 Pandemic. This exhibit is a reflection on the Kodiak experience of the COVID-19 pandemic, and we are opening up these reflections and conversations on a different platform. This show. Our intent in creating the show is to facilitate conversations about this ongoing pandemic, which is truly history in the making. The Kodiak History Museum is excited to work with KMXT on this program, and we are looking forward to hearing from you. This is our first show out of four total that will take place once a month this spring. Today, our guests are City of Kodiak Mayor Pat Branson, Providence COVID Incident Commander Amy Corder, Dr. Shanna Theobald, and Dr. Evan Jones. Welcome, everyone. Pat Branson will be joining us shortly after our meeting this morning. Let's start off with a recap of what has been happening in Kodiak.
What has been happening in Kodiak? There is a big question, huh?
Yeah.
What is happening in Kodiak? From a medical standpoint, you know, the perception seems to be that the pandemic is sort of winding, the Omicron surge is sort of winding down. Our numbers are still fairly high, but on the ground, what are you seeing?
I think the overall burden is starting to go down. The number of active cases is starting to go down. And this is kind of following the same pattern as we've seen in other places with Omicron, that it's about a 6 weeks before it really starts trending downwards. And I think we're going to continue to follow that pattern. I was hoping we'd mostly be done with it this week, but I was a little optimistic. I think it's going to take a few more weeks for us to be mostly done with it. We had a pretty big surge of infections in the beginning, which made me feel like we could be through this fairly quickly, but it's slowly decreasing.
And this is Amy, the hospital side, we're starting to see what we anticipated of increased hospitalizations. Today we have 4 COVID positive patients up on the floor. So we are seeing that the statewide is starting to see those hospitalizations. We know that that typically lags 1 to 2 weeks behind the community numbers. So we anticipated to see that increase occurring at this juncture.
Interesting that as a nation, the death rate is extremely high. And purely because we're getting unprecedented numbers. And it's, it doesn't mean that it's on a per disease person more deadly. It just means that way more people are diseased right now at the same time. And so because of that, deaths are up there, but it may not be as deadly a disease as the previous variants. Still dangerous, but not as deadly as it had been in the past.
Well, how's our flu season looking so far? I mean, we had a year where it went away last year for all intents and purposes, and now it seems to be rearing its head again in a not too friendly strain, right?
I still haven't seen as much of that as I have RSV. To me, RSV was by far the most surprising thing, how much of it popped up in the past month. I don't know how Kayak's numbers are for flu, but I haven't felt like that we were overwhelmed by it yet. But it might be just because I just haven't been in a position to see all of them.
I would say based on our testing here at the hospital, we're seeing that same thing. A lot of the respiratory viral stuff that's coming in is either COVID or RSV. And we do have some flu occurring, but not nearly the numbers of the other two.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're seeing at our clinic.
So how is testing going, and how is ongoing vaccinations going? Have we plateaued?
It seems to be a little bit flat. I still get them. We're not getting huge numbers anymore. I think with each wave, we get a few more people who are willing to come in. A lot of them are just booster shots at this point. But I don't think there's a ton of, and there's some new vaccinations that come in, but nothing huge. It's still steady, but nothing, no huge numbers.
Well, how much input do you get from people with all the home testing available now? How do we know that the numbers we're reporting are real?
That's a great question. I can speak to testing from our clinic, and then I also talked to the lab director at Canada this morning, and obviously Dr. Jones is more in the know on that data. But we are seeing a decline in the number of people we're testing. We were at our max around 150 to nearly 200 a day. And of those, about a third, 33% were positive. And then now we're down to low hundreds, and about 25% or a quarter of them are positive. We are testing fewer people, but the real predictor, I think, of how the trend is going right now is the percent positivity rate, which is also decreasing. And I know I talked to Ashley Frost, the lab director at Canada, and she was saying kind of the same thing. They're testing around 200 or so, or they were testing around 200 to 300, and a third of those are positive. And now this last week, it's been around mid hundreds to 200, and 25, 27% are positive. Hopefully that means we're trending down, but I agree. We're still, 4 to 6 weeks is kind of the general peak period for the Omicron surge. So we still have time to see how this is going to play out.
I don't think we're ever going to know the real numbers from the beginning when this first came through. How many people have you guys seen tested where one person in the family gets tested and they're positive, and they just assume the rest of the family is positive, when we're having numbers of positives in the 300 or 400? I would have told you, I felt like that the real number could be 1,000 today. It would not surprise me if we have two unreported positives, people who just know, okay, well, my wife has it and I feel sick too. What's the point of me going in? Or it's still hard to find these home tests. There's not a ton of them. The school district is doing a great job of getting out there. And those numbers, if through the school district, they do kind of get reported because there is a follow-up with the school district. But most of the others, there's no reporting for it. They're unknown positives. And we're kind of discussing before the show, is it important at this point? It's nice to know. I don't know if it's going to change what we're doing. And it's kind of like what other people have used the analogy of riding the dragon. I think we've talked about that. That are we just on top of a dragon along for the ride, or are we actually doing anything about it? And so sometimes it's nice to know where you're going, but how much you can control it is tough to say. There are little things we can do, and that's helpful. But for a large part, we're along for the ride.
Well, are you concerned about the change and the confusion caused by the rollback in the CDC recommendations as to what how long you stay quarantined if you test positive, and how that affects the other people in your household and the people you work with?
So this has actually been looked into, a couple of studies, some of them really small. One of them was just 25 people that I saw. 13 out of 25 still had a potentially transmissible disease at day five was done. They still had potentially transmissible disease, but 25 is not a very good number to make any conclusions from. Another was over 400. There's multiple studies out there, and it seems to range anywhere from 1 in 7 people may have transmissible virus to 1 in 3 for the bigger studies. And so the concern was, could we be passing this around? Absolutely. It's definitely possible. But the big thing is, I do think their recommendations are a little bit confusing. I get why people are frustrated with it. I wish I could share with you guys here, but there's a doctor who has this kind of comedy, who he talks about the CDC, how it's confusing to doctors too. But the truth of the matter is, if we do what it says, where we're wearing a mask after testing positive when we return to work, that's going to be helpful. The CDC did not specify what type of mask. And I actually think, for the good of your neighbors, it would be good for you to wear an N95 mask for a few days if you can tolerate it. I realize a lot of people can't. They are tough. There are better N95s than others for breathing, and look for one that works for you. But if I'm to be truthful, if you're being a good neighbor, I think wearing an N95 when you come back. So you quarantine for 5 days. If you have no symptoms, no general symptoms, you have to look at the list. You can return to work and wear a mask for 5 more days. But I think a simple mask probably is not adequate.
So on the medical portion, before we go into the bigger picture questions, I just want to close with, how concerned should we be with the new stealth variant of Omicron? Is it just another thing down the road? And are we just going to keep seeing these things? Should we actually be more attentive because there's another one coming? Or is this just going to be, Delta, Omicron, BA.2, and then something else down the road?
From what I've read, we don't know enough about the stealth Omicron yet, how virulent and or, transmissible it's going to be. There might be more information, and I'm not up to date on the latest on it. But that's exactly why we're still in a pandemic phase of this, and not necessarily endemic, because we don't know what's going to come next. We're not sure yet if we're through these surges, if we're through, these variants that really do increase one of those three factors that make it more potentially, or increase morbidity and mortality in our population. So it remains to be seen. I wish we could predict it, but at this time, I think we're still watching carefully, being vigilant, and like Amy has been talking about, looking at kind of the big public health factors. Where are we at with our community? And until we can kind of see a more level numbers throughout, you know, a few months, we're still kind of just watching and being careful.
And I lied. In your correspondence, I noticed that you wanted to talk about the fourth vaccine. Are we having discussions now about possibly making a fourth vaccine available to a certain population?
Yeah, there is a fourth vaccine in Israel. They've been rolling it out and studying the effects of it. There is increased antibody activity after getting the fourth vaccine. At this time, it's recommended in the U.S. for people who are severely immunocompromised. Most people don't meet that definition. About 7 million people in our nation of 330 million people really meet that criteria. And we're not, the studies right now are looking at how much does it really increase the effectiveness of immunity. Antibodies aren't the only way to tell immunity. There's T cell activity, as Dr. Jones has talked about before. There's other, you know, parts of our immune system. And really, time will tell with the new studies and the new variants coming out how good the booster vaccine or the fourth, second booster will really be with the surge of Omicron. But time will tell. In the meantime, we're kind of waiting and seeing. And there's been a lot of questions about the fourth vaccine, so I wanted to kind of put that information out to the broad public that at this time, maybe 1-2% of the population qualify for that fourth dose, and it may or may not really make a huge difference for the rest of us. So in the meantime, we're gonna try to get the whole world immunized with the first two or maybe three doses and see what happens next.
But we have a huge surplus of vaccine in town here, don't we? I mean, you've got more vaccine to give than there are people wanting to take it. And at some point in time, it's going to expire, right? Is there a way you can take it and send it to Africa, or, you know what I mean?
That's an excellent question. Yes, we do have more vaccine available. And I think, you know, within the next few weeks before it expires, we'll know more about that fourth dose and be able to get people in who are high. After the severely immunocompromised kind of highest triage risk, then we go to the people who are more likely to have waning immunity, so elders, people who are more likely to have severe illness, and then kind of use it up as we know more and then triage the higher risk populations. And I wish we could share it with the rest of the world that needs it and that none of it would go to waste. And unfortunately, it's just impossible. The way that it's tracked, the way that it's, the conditions it's needed to be kept in at freezing conditions, there's just no way to more equitably distribute it once it goes out from the manufacturers or the state distributors.
Speaking of availability, we just had a question come through. Where can we get N95 masks in town?
You can order them online. They are available now, and they make sure they're actually proven and accurate and not knockoffs. In our clinic, I've been giving them out to people who haven't been able to get them. We're doing that very carefully, though, because we don't want to run out from the healthcare provider side of things. But they are still available for purchase at this time.
Awesome. Okay, we have Pat Branson that just joined us. Welcome, Pat.
Well, good morning. I'm sorry I'm late. I was on a call with Speaker Stutz, but I gave Mike a heads up about that, so I apologize for being late.
That is totally fine. Are we ready to move on? Okay. So the first question that we have to pose to you guys, how has the pandemic directly affected you personally? What have you had to do personally to be able to cope with dealing with this in your everyday life?
Well, I can speak to that. I don't mind. Thank you, I'm late. So personally, and with people I know, it's kind of put the brakes on what's important and what are the priorities in life and reevaluating what you're doing and maybe picking up some new activities since we haven't been able to gather very much. For me, it was continuing to hike this summer, gardening. I have an extensive garden in my front yard, reading. And one thing that I picked up that was brought me joy was learning how to cook and then delivering food at the door of friends. So I had people that wanted to get on the delivery route. And so it's reevaluating what's important and thinking outside the box and trying to keep focused on some positive things. And it's been very hard, not together, but I think you've got some questions related to that. But for personally, that's how I've been able to cope. And also, I have to admit, some binging some movies and series that I picked up.
At least you can blame it on the pandemic, huh?
Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
You can blame it on the pandemic. I watch too much TV.
Well, it's not TV. It's, you know, movies and series, which is not primetime TV. I don't watch that. So I want to make that clear.
Yeah. Amy, you want to?
I think for me, it's made me really evaluate what I do and how my relationship is with my job. I know I honestly feel I feel called to being a doctor. People who know me know that's not who I am. It doesn't encompass my entire being, but I do feel called to this profession, and it's made me more careful. I'm usually pretty. I take risks, and it's just the way I am. I'm a little more risk taker, and I've had to rein myself in and realize that I can't really. I frankly, when we have these surges, I stop going to church because I can't afford to be out for a week. I have a lot of patients who depend on me, and frankly, a lot of coworkers who are going to be put out if I turn positive. I've been more conscientious about being safe myself and not doing quite as many social activities, which I love. The Joe Floyd tournament, I love. I love going to at least one or two of those games. I didn't go this year, just trying to make sure that I'm available for patients and not homesick. And so it has changed the way my behavior is and thinking about the importance of what I do for a living. And just to be clear, it's being a doctor is not who I am. It doesn't encompass my identity, but I had to look at, I am important to a lot of people. And so I have to take that into consideration when I'm doing activities. So I've cut back on my risk taking in some areas. But at the same time, I've become more of a counselor than a physician, because being honest with you, there's not a ton that we do as doctors about Lyme disease. There's some things. But my big thing this year is trying to get people to not be afraid. Be careful, but don't be afraid. I think fear has led to a lot of the behavior that we've seen in our community and across the nation. That's been unfortunate and has hit the headlines. And just that fear of change, the fear of the unknown has been really hard on people. And so I'm asking people to start thinking about what the future looks like in relation to this disease and how do we start learning to live with it.
Amy, you want to jump in on that one?
Sure. For me personally, similar themes, kind of that reevaluating what's important and who's important. Early on, you developed your social bubble that was pretty small and limited. So instead of having 20 different friends that I spent time with every once in a while, I developed this really small core group that has become truly our family, in a sense. Far more depth of relationship than we probably would have had in the same 2-year time frame without the pandemic, because they're the group of us that always do stuff together. And the other part that I reflect back and kind of think what has changed, when I watch my daughter interact with cousins or friends, and they're on FaceTime and they're playing together because they have learned how to play with their dolls through a screen, which has created a different kind of connection with the cousins. It's not just a phone call. It's not just something like that. We can have family game night, or similar to how we're doing this radio thing where we're all sitting in our own offices or home spaces and communicating together. And that wouldn't have happened pre-pandemic. We've leaned into some healthy pieces to the technology, in my thoughts, where we can have that connection in a way with people who aren't physically here. And then the ones who are, that connection is deeper and more meaningful to me. So I think for me, those are kind of the twofold good and bad of the going into your social bubble and into your own home, finding alternative ways that have allowed us to connect off island in a more meaningful and daily way than we ever did before.
Shanna, you get to go last.
Yeah, I echo what everyone else has said, Pat, even, and Amy. Traveling is a big thing. I love to travel, and I haven't traveled nearly as much, even going home to see my family. And then also, it's made me really think a lot more about food security and healthy choices. And I agree with Pat. I've been gardening a lot more and really trying to think about, like, you know, what can I provide for myself here? Gets me outside a lot more. And I agree. I appreciate friends and family connections more than ever now. And I think we are all not taking that as much for granted.
So I'm going to start with you on this one, Amy. How has the pandemic affected your workplace, and what kind of effects are you seeing on your staff and on the people who come to the hospital?
I think similar to what Dr. Jones reflected on in the what's changed, people are recognizing the calling of what they do. Hand in hand with that, though, there is a level of burnout. It's tiring to do it. And so finding that resiliency has been important for our teams together. And how do we work through this storm in the, you know, we're going through it all together. And so those connections within ourselves has been important. It's led us to really look at how do we creatively continue to keep things open and what things are most important to our patients and to the community, and how do we avoid shutdowns of those service lines. And that's led us to get really creative in some of the things that we've done. And at the hospital, we're moving now to how do we operationalize this, because we know these waves are likely going to continue, and how do we just make that part of how we operate and take the good things we've learned from this and make it part of our daily routine and practice. And the interdisciplinary teamwork has always been an important factor, but when you've been short-staffed because people are out sick and increasing hospitalizations, that has become a whole new level of teamwork, where teams who didn't necessarily interact that much have interacted a lot more. And we appreciate all the little things that happen in the background and we don't think about have been more appreciated. So I think it just gives you that holistic view working with each other.
Well, there seems to be a nationwide concern about morale and staffing in hospitals. Are you seeing the same thing in Kodiak, or are we faring a little bit better here?
I think it's a mixed bag of that. I think overall the hospital morale is improving. The cohesion of a team is there. People are here because of the calling. We recognize when each other are feeling that burnout and try to give each other that space. But when you're working your fourth 12-hour shift in a row because there's not staff to do it, it's tiring. When you have patients in front of you who are sicker than we traditionally, historically had kept on island because there's nowhere to send them off island, that's nerve-wracking, as you don't want to do anything that's going to harm them, and you've always been able to get that support from off island. And so it's leaning in, and how do we train and grow in that? But that growth is scary and complex. And so I think it's a mixed bag of emotions, and from one beginning of one shift to end of one shift, you can run that whole gamut in an individual but trying to just recognize that everyone else is going through that same thing that's here too, and really supporting each other.
Pat, how have you fared at the senior center? You're muted.
You think I would do this by now? I don't know. I was watching the Eagles outside my window here, so you got to take advantage of that flying around. So at the senior center, we've had to think outside the box, like many other agencies, and how we're delivering services and in keeping staff safe, and so that we can deliver services. We don't have a big staff here. And so what we have done is we've created curbside meals that people can drive up, and seniors, anyone 60 and older, and get a meal at the back door. It's like going through McDonald's, only it's better food. And that's between 12 and 1, 5 days a week. We have had our adult day program open. It's really been important to have it open when it's been possible. So it's been open and closed. It's closed right now because of the high case count, but we're doing pods of adult day service to certain groups that we feel that are safe. We've continued with putting lifelines in, which is very important for seniors to have so they can push a button if they need help. We've called people. We call people on a regular basis. We have continued some respite and chore when it's been safe, and doing some screening before we have our staff go into the home. It's been very strange not having congregate setting with seniors coming in and having six people to a table and socializing every day. We were open for a little while and having four people to a table. Then it went to two people to a table. And now we're not open at all with that. But what we have found on a positive note is that there have people who have come for curbside meals who have never been to the senior center before, whether it was for eating a meal or anything. So we've more than doubled our number of meals that we serve in a congregate setting or curbside, as well as home delivered meals. People who needed home delivered meals previously are getting them. And so that's been a trigger with this pandemic, is that there's a realization there with being at home and keeping people safe. So we've kept staff on board. We have applied for, you know, the two PPP grants and been forgiven on them. So we've kept our staff employed and have found that we have put them in other places in the center to help out when it's been needed. So it's been difficult with seniors not being able to socialize, but I think we've done our best in keeping that movement in place with phone calls and doing one-on-one pods with our adult day. Phone calls make a big difference, just checking in with people. So that's what we've done. I can speak for senior service providers across the state that everybody's had to readjust what they've done, especially in a congregate setting. So it's working, and you know, people love these curbside meals, and it may be a whole new way of delivering meals and not having people have options. So that's what we're still doing. So it's been open and closed with certain programs depending on the case count and keeping our staff safe. I'm just speaking here from a provider standpoint and not the mayor's standpoint, is my understanding. Right. That's a whole nother arena, and I'm not going there, I guess.
Well, the socialization component is concerning. I mean, are you concerned about the mental health of the senior population, or do you think we're faring okay?
I think we're faring okay. I think that contact, and, you know, we have people that call and want to visit people. It's like, well, it's, why don't you do some daily calls or get on a little schedule of calling people or sending cards? We've had different schools in the community want to send out cards and notes to seniors, which is great. And we encourage that. So there are different ways of doing things and socializing with people. And you can do FaceTime. A lot of the seniors are very literate in computer skills. We've got classes here and at the college. So there are ways to doing it. And just, it's not any different than what you're doing with, as what Amy described, in that you have a social bubble, but you have friends. And how is your daughter socializing with her friends? It's the same kind of thing with seniors. I really can say that I haven't seen a remark, although we do have seniors call. I've had this and just want to sit and talk to one of our staff, which is fine. We're here to do that. And, you know, just to talk about what's going on with them. So I would encourage people, they know people, elderly in the community, just to get people a call and send them a card. It's always fun to get things in the mail. So I think we're doing okay. And I think the way of doing business is changing for a lot of social service agencies, and including ours. And some of those practices will continue to be in play.
Dr. Jones, at CANA, you're at the forefront. You know, you've probably seen the increased traffic in the last 2 years that is beyond anything you've ever seen before. How's the workplace changed at CANA?
I think the workers at CANA are doing very well. Medical workers in general are getting under higher and higher demand. And so it has changed companies. And I don't want to say that about CANA specifically, because being honest with you, 10 years ago, CANA was kind of a revolving door for medical providers, where they had a service requirement, they did their 3 or 4 years, and then they left. And there's been a fundamental change at CANA that we want long-term providers. And so they've become more competitive salary-wise and trying to work with people to get them to stay, figuring out how we can make this a long-term workplace. And they've been successful. We've had people sticking around for a long time now. But I think the hospital, CANA everywhere, is kind of used to saying this is the way we're doing it, and we don't have much flexibility. This is the way it's done. And companies are having to learn that we're going to have to be a little more flexible here, because people are leaving, and they're leaving faster than we can replace them. And that's a pretty tough deal, to replace nurses in the hospital. And so we've actually, and there's a lot of attractive offers out there at the hospital. You can be a traveler nurse and make way more than you can by being a permanent full-time nurse. And so people are like, well, I can have control over my own schedule then and get paid more. You might not get the benefits, but that's kind of attractive for a lot of people, especially single men and women who are nurses and can travel whenever they want. And so it's made it harder to staff virtually any medical place, knowing that they can get a job anywhere in the country and have more control over their own schedule. And so I think companies are starting to realize we got to have a little more flexibility here. And if people want to work 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, how can we make this work, rather than say, no, we don't do that. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take some time. I think the CEO at Providence Kodiak has really been receptive to how do we retain employees, where that, I don't know, that's necessarily been the case in the past at times. And I know at CANA, slowly trying to figure out how to make it work and have people stay longer and be happier in their jobs. It's going to take a while for big places to change, but it is a transition that was necessary before this all started, and it's even more emphasized now.
Shanna, let's let you finish up on this question.
It's easy to go last. I get to just echo what everybody else says. I know my elder patients really miss the senior center and that kind of connection they got to have. They all get it, though. They're all, you know, understand the why, and they're all at high risk. So it's easy, but that is an amazing service, and I'm glad that's here for them. I think just in the daily grind at our clinic at work, we have had a lot of turnover at our clinic. We have had a lot of burnout, people out sick, and then we just have to give each other that extra measure of grace and pick up the slack where it needs to be picked up. I do a lot more of just taking vitals and checking patients in and jumping in where, you know, giving injections or whatever the nurses would do, but they're out testing everybody. So we're all just kind of filling in where we can. The daily grind is a little bit more grindy because, you know, you've always got to put that PPE on and washing your hands and kind of being vigilant. But I agree too. It is our calling, and you jump in when you have to jump in. We are resilient, and I think we get to see that a little bit more with this.
Okay. Our next question is, would you agree that we are in some ways a community divided? Do you feel there's less trust in the medical community now than there was before the pandemic? If so, what can we do to turn things around?
Shanna.
I don't think we're...
Okay, Pat. Go ahead, Pat.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't think we're much different than the rest of the country at this point. However, I believe that Kodiak has a real sense of community here. And that's always been the case in my 40 years living here. Are we divided? I wouldn't use that word. I think there are differing opinions out there on how people have reacted to the pandemic. And those are people's choices. However, I think the key word here, and this is something I'm just putting on my mayor hat here, is that respect is absolutely needed. And so that's a key word for me and one I would throw out there. But I don't know that I would use the word divided. I certainly, listening to school board meetings, the borough meetings, and experiencing at the city council meetings, there have been people who really have not been very respectful and in their comments to people who are just trying to do the best job they can. And that's for the medical community as well. But that's the word I would keep out there, is that people need to be respectful of others. I think that there is more trust in the medical community. That's been my take during this pandemic. I am so glad that we have the medical community that we have in Kodiak. Being in a remote area, my husband had to be medevaced out in September, and the care that he received was incredible here and as well as in Anchorage. But would I, as a senior, and my husband, much older than I am, I might add, would we be living here if there wasn't that healthcare? No, I think, you know, it's education and healthcare that keep people here. So I'm very grateful for, we have different healthcare systems here, whether it's tribal, the Coast Guard, or Providence, or the community health clinic. And I think during this pandemic, those barriers between healthcare providers have really come down from what I have seen and heard. And I am grateful for and have all the utmost respect for our medical providers in this community. So I'd like to stay away from the word divided, and I would focus on a more positive word and just being respectful for people's beliefs.
Somebody else wants to jump in on that one?
I think Shanna wanted to. She didn't want to wait till last this time.
I agree, Pat, and I really love what you said. I think, yeah, there has been differences of opinion, and some have been very strong. I think, unfortunately, a lot of this got politicized, which is tough because I think the beauty of our American system is having our republic and our democracy and the independence, and I love those different opinions, and I think that really makes us stronger in the end to have that kind of diversity. There's both. I think there's a lot of trust in the medical community. I think I have seen some people that are more, you know, because it's been politicized, I think it has led to a lot of questions and some misinformation, disinformation. But I think, yeah, I agree with Pat overall. I mean, this, most of our life is outside of politics. It's eating, breathing, sleeping, you know, being in community with each other. And I think when we kind of see that bigger picture, especially in Kodiak, where we need each other to get through the year, that really does help kind of refocus it. And it does bring that level of respect. But excellent questions.
Amy, you want to pipe in on this one?
I kind of echo the same thing. I think there's more things that still keep us similar than keep us divided, and we can have differences of opinions of that, but we see when something happens in the community and we need to rally behind a family or behind some event that happened, the community comes out, and it doesn't matter those politicized belief pieces. And so I like to keep that in the forefront of what we remember when we have those discussions. I think one of the things this has done is we've always encouraged our patients to ask questions about their healthcare and to be informed about the things that we're doing. And I think patients are doing that a little bit more because of that. So kind of that silver lining to the political divide that occurred with this is I think it is opening conversations between providers and their patients about their overall health and why we make the recommendations we make. And both the doctors on the call here have gone through extensive education and training and have a deep understanding of how all of our bodies work. And so being able to communicate that and have a chance to really engage with the patients, I think has been something I've heard through our medical staff has been a little bit of a benefit, being able to open up that conversation more than it's been before.
Dr. Jones, you get to close out the first program with...
So my big thing through all this has been this division didn't start with COVID. There's been lots of divisions that have come up over the few years, even before COVID, and this kind of accentuated the cracks, and I choose to ignore them. My choice of it is to really learn where people are coming from. I don't care if it's political or medical. People can have really crazy medical beliefs, and if I'm like, that is idiotic, I've just turned off anything I have to say after that. Nothing I have to say is going to get into the patient because I've just put them on the opposite side of me. But coming beside people and learning why they think that and kind of not turning them off completely and saying that's wrong, but nudging them in the right direction and helping them understand. I have patients who... we get along great, who are firmly anti-vaxxers with the COVID. And I tease them. I'm like, you're going to feel a pinch in your butt one day. That's going to be me with a dart gun vaccinating you. And rather than making it a big deal, it's making it funny, but educating at the same time and helping them be okay with this, that it's when the fear creeps in and we see people as the enemy and see people as different than us. I don't care if it's black and white. I don't care if it's vaccinated or unvaccinated or masked or unmasked. That fear that creeps in is what divides us. It's not real issues. It's real emotions that are dividing us. And I think it's so important that we're masters of our own ship, where we don't let our fear and our differences divide us, but we figure out, how can we come beside people and help guide them along the way? There's so many ways we're different, and that's okay. But there's so many ways, like people have said already, that we're alike, that we can find common ground with everybody. And so finding that common ground, and instead of face-to-face disagreeing with them, coming beside them and guiding them along the way.
Well, I really thank you all for your time this morning and your thoughtfulness. I know the community would appreciate it. This is the first in many of these conversations. There's conversations like this going on every day throughout our community. We're hoping through this program to stir some more. And next month we'll have another slate of goods. We didn't even get to all the questions that we had to ask, so we may have to rethink how we're doing things enough. But yeah. From the KMXD studios, Lynn Walker, Mike Wall, saying thank you and have a pleasant day.
Thank you.